Hello, Story Seekers. I'm Ben.
I'm Nico, and welcome to The Tiny Bookcase and our Novella Writing Month miniseries.
February is the shortest month, so it feels suitably contrary that we attempt to write something longer than our normal fare.
We will also be writing our novella together, which will be the first time we've written something substantial with each other, ever.
In this first episode, we'll be drilling down into what we want from our novella and discussing approaches to co-writing.
As our regular listeners will know, this novella is going to be about my favourite fantasy race, dwarves. So, let's get hammering.
Where does that come from? I think potentially this might be a sort of thing to discuss later, but the whole Scottish dwarf thing, where does that come from? Do you know?
I have no idea. It just seems to have been a thing that was decided. I think what's really funny about it is even Gimli, in Peter Jackson's incredible Lord of the Rings movies, people think of him as being Scottish, in spite of the fact that John Rhys-Davies is so aggressively Welsh.
Yeah, he is.
If
That's
people do a Gimli voice, they'll go into a Scottish accent a lot of the time. It's fascinating. So like it's just so built in.
Like a sort of homogenisation of Celtic under the Scottish banner.
But maybe...
Just when you mentioned Gimli then, I was thinking, if anyone's listening to this and they've got like a Ben and Nico Discuss Dwarves bingo, mentioning Gimli and the Lord of the Rings must be, like, they're already completed half a row.
It's, interestingly, though, in the world of Warhammer, canonically, they've all got northern accents, but not Scottish. There's one clan who are very specifically Scottish.
So they all speak like Sean Bean?
They do. So, Gotrek Gernison, there's another one for your bingo card.
Nice.
Got like a broad northern accent. Oh, seeking me doom, I am. Can't wait to die, me.
I did read somewhere that the more sort of pervasive side of the dwarves in popular culture that comes through from like tabletop gaming and this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Apparently, Gary Gygax based the original dwarves in his. In the D&D universe that he was writing in, what was it, like the 70s and 80s or something?
Yeah.
On a short story about a dwarf who was Scottish. And that's potentially one of the ways that it got in. But that, to me, that doesn't sound like that. That sounds like it was already a thing before he did that.
Yes. Because there must have been some precedence. I'm gonna do something that's going to happen a lot, gang. I'm going to Google it. This is going to be one of those things where there are so many answers.
And, I think it's just a fact, isn't it, at the moment? This is one of the things that people are aware of when you talk about dwarves.
Some people, it's widely believed, but, you know, it hadn't got wide enough for us yet, that Tolkien drew inspiration from a mix of Scandinavian and Scottish culture when creating the dwarves and their language. So it might be that there's some actual Scottish mixed into the dwarven tongue. But it was a roll of the dice, essentially, from the sound of it. They're either going to be a Scottish sounding or a Scandi sounding.
I could have done with that. Scandi dwarves. That kind of like lilting.
We do have a lot of that survives too, though, hasn't it? You know, you get a lot of dwarves called Snorri and...
That's true. Yeah, naming convention has carried on with that. Right, well, I think before we get any further into like what we're going to do with dwarves and how we're going to twist more established thinking on them, we should probably talk about what a novella actually is, because we write a lot of short stories. Some of them are more like flash fiction, so that's typically you know, under 1,000 words, maybe under even like under 800, under 500 sometimes. Although I don't think we've ever written that little, but... Sort of microfiction is under, you know, 200. Then you get flash, which goes up to about 800 to 1,000. And then short stories are typically somewhere between 1,000 and 3,000 words. Then there's a big jump.
Yes.
Which is the next one. I think there are some other bits in between, but the main next one is novella, which, as it sounds like, is a diminutive novel. And Whereas a novel can be, you know, 120,000 words if it's an absolute doorstop. Or at the very minimum, it's probably around 80,000,
60,000.
80 to 90, yeah. You know, 80 to 90, yeah, something like that. Novellas tend to hit more in the 20,000 to 40,000 words. And I know I'm just saying a lot of numbers at the moment, but it does matter because, as you've probably heard from the episodes that we've done, sometimes you have an idea and it's just too big for the word count, or it's too little. And I think novellas have an opportunity to sort of be neither one thing nor t'other.
Yeah.
They're not, they are sort of a long short story, but they're also a short novel. And our approach will, you know, the success of our approach will hinge on how we interpret that, I think.
I mean, in our style, typically, Ben, what's going to happen is that we're going to try and write a novella and come up with a concept that is absolutely meant to be written at novel length.
Well, we can give it a go. We can give it a go. Back.
Yeah.
But we can't go over 40,000. I think that's the cap. That I think that's where the Nebula category, you know, the awards, the Nebula awards. I think that's where they cut off. Anything over 40,000 isn't a novella as far as they see it.
Okay.
Just
a short novel at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's when I was looking around to sort of think about ways to describe novellas, I found a really good article from Ian McEwan in The New Yorker.
Yeah.
Where he said that he believes the novella is the perfect form of prose fiction, which is a big claim. It is the beautiful daughter of a rambling, bloated, ill-shaven giant, but a giant who is a genius on his best days. That's the way that he described it.
He should have put that in a book. No, it's a lovely sentiment. It's interesting as well to say it's the perfect form, just because it does mean that you sort of write off the concept of the epic as ever being able to be the greatest tale.
Yeah, yeah, I could sort of see that. Yeah, the idea that it can't be this, just the magnitude of it can't be enormous, like the physical size of it can't be enormous.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the article was really quite interesting because it sort of opened with him sort of meditating on this idea that there is this idea that you're being sort of shortchanged as a reader when you read a novella.
Yeah.
Like perhaps you don't have the necessary creative juice to write a novel. You know, why is it only 100 pages long? You know, there's a brevity to it that maybe leaves people who aren't expecting it out of the loop.
Yeah.
But one of my favorite books ever is a novella, which is Conrad's Heart of Darkness. That's not really a novel; that's more of a novella. So I think this idea that it's neither one thing nor the other, as I said, that's actually could be its strength. You know, it has all of like the laser focus required from a short story. Like McEwan says that it needs to have like the central idea of a novella should be always exerting its gravitational pull. And
yeah.
I can definitely see that. Like all of the successful novellas that I've read have done that. But also it has to have like a bit, you know, more of a scope. Maybe even a subplot or two.
Yeah. I can see it. Like in a novel you can spend some time, I guess the right phrase would be like lounging in the prose. Like allowing the world to breathe, but you in a novella, you kind of want it to be, you're not suffocating it, but it's flying so fast that it doesn't have time for the in-breath. It just has to breathe everything out that it's got and see what happens. I like that sort of idea around it, that it's not...
You're sort of discussing pacing there, aren't you? I think that's like...
Yeah, I think, you know, so.
Where you would sort of naturally incline towards... Yeah, no, I like that. I think that would work. I don't think I can describe novellas better than that as other people, and there's plenty of other places on the internet for people to do that. So that sort of brings us to how we're going to do it. You know, how are we going to actually write this together?
Yeah, it's a spicy one because we are definitely both pantsers, at least to a degree.
Yeah, I think so. I think I've started to lean away from the sort of binary nature of it to a certain degree. Mm. I know sometimes when I have an idea now, it's like a version of the ending that will happen.
Yes.
But there's still some excitement when you are writing, because it's not, maybe it turns out that isn't the right ending and you find the true ending somewhere else, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I think, especially when we are co-writing, you're right, like, maybe we do need to have, like, a more sort of, like, pointed goal. Like an aim, so that we're both pulling in the same direction, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's... I think just trusting each other is going to be a big part of this, which is lucky, because we do.
Yeah.
But I think knowing that, like, maybe something's going to happen in the other person's writing, that you just got to be like, don't be precious in both directions. Like, if you write something and it completely changes how dwarves work in our world, then I can't be like, but I already wrote a chapter. Like, you got to be willing to go back in and and yank. But in the same way that if one of us goes, oh, I've had this concept and I think it's really cool, you got to be ready for the other person to say, I think it's cool, but maybe it doesn't work in this world, or actually I think you've gone absolutely balmy and lost the plot. And I think that's where trust is going to be a huge factor in this, because you have to not only be comfortable with getting feedback from the other person, which, spoiler, if you've never listened to the podcast before, we've had a lot of practice at that. but also, yeah, being brave enough to take a hit, because it can be absolutely crushing, especially if you're really trying to achieve something. I think that's going to be one of the toughest parts of this process, is being able to say or accept when someone says, I'm sorry, it just doesn't work. I'm going, yeah, you're right, and yanking things out.
I mean, that's I totally agree, and I think that's very much built on things that we've discussed in the podcast before, like this idea of collaborative storytelling that we both do recreationally anyway.
Yeah.
It does rely on, sometimes, you know, someone will say, oh, you know, this could be a good idea, and then somebody else might say, okay, that's almost there, what about if you tweak it this way?
Yeah.
And it's a very, as long as you're adding to it and like moving things forwards, I think it's always a positive process, even if it can be quite destructive sometimes, because you can lose whole concepts and ideas and trains of thoughts to a new idea. I really like that. So what I did was I went away and with some of my knowledge of some of the co-writing duos that I'm aware of, I just sort of looked them up just to get some examples. So maybe we could like chat through these and then see if there's anything that sticks.
Yeah, sure.
So I've mentioned Hard to Be a God, I think, a couple of times on the podcast, which is a Russian novel, science fiction novel from the 60s or so. And it's written by a brother duo. It was written by Boris and Arkady Strugatsky, so the Strugatsky brothers. And I mean, they had a really interesting life. They, for example, they survived the siege of Leningrad as kids in World War II and things like that.
Oh, wow.
And they were also writing under a time of great censorship. Like, they frequently had to change like the names of characters in their books because they were too close to like leading members of the ruling government and things like that. But the way that they did it, the actual writing of it, they passed the whole fucking thing back and forth. So one would have it for a bit, write on it, and then give it to the other brother, and then they would read it all through, write a bit more, give it back, that kind of thing. Now, that sounds pretty good if you've got the time for it and all the rest of it, but also like tremendously laborious. It almost sounds like
that's
they would
exhausting.
End up with it. Yeah, the whole thing, because virtually every bit of advice that we've had from writers that have come on the podcast has been to write first, then edit, not edit and write at the same time, which is essentially what it sounds like the Strugatsky brothers were doing. So it's one way of doing it, and quite a famous way of doing it, but maybe not for us. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't think passing the whole thing back and forth constantly is is our style. I think it's definitely, like, I think there's something to be lifted from it. like, if you've written a chapter, to create a kind of, like, scrub notes version. Like, these are the beats. This is... And then, like, passing the beats, and then keeping... Like, if you're adding those beats together, mm-hmm. so it's like, instead of, like, here's the whole book, read it, I've added a chapter, it goes in this space, here are the beats. Because then you can, like, rapid fire read through the whole book as notes. I think there's something there. I don't think it's a whole thing, but I think, yeah, just so you can be like, wait a minute, 5 notes ago I read something, and this has resolved it weirdly, or kind of unmade it.
Okay, I think I like that. So that's like almost like a living storyboard where each chapter is, it has an outline that so we sort of know what's happening in, and it also allows you to jump around, so you don't have to write in a linear fashion as well.
Yeah, I like that. Sense check a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a big thing in IT, the concept of a fresh pair of eyes being it's often referred to as rubber ducking. That's because a lot of people in the Google server rooms have a rubber duck on top of their machine. And it's because if you're stuck on a problem, you tell your duck. Because so many times, just verbalizing it helps you solve it. Because in explaining it, your brain spins around the base concepts and you solve it. And it works even better with another person who, if you're just that little bit short, they can go, well, yeah, you taught me this, or no, you know about this, it's this. So I think sort of having that in an active writing document could fix a lot of plot problems, especially if you're like, I don't know how this scene resolves. Like, just telling the scene to each other,
mm-hmm.
or reading another scene, it can help you to go, oh, no, what am I talking about? Of course this is what happens.
There's also, inbuilt in that, there's the concept of who is the rubber duck in the scenario, because there'll be times when one of us needs to give the outline to the other one and vice versa. So knowing who the rubber duck is in the conversation is quite good, like who's the wall that the ideas are bouncing around off.
Yeah.
I like that. I think that's good. So I had some more.
Do slap me with one.
So the big one that we've definitely discussed before, is Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett writing Good Omens together.
Never heard of them.
Which originally came from a shorter starter idea that Gaiman wrote and Pratchett read. And apparently Pratchett called him and said, either I need to buy this idea off you so I can write it, or we need to write it together. And Neil Gaiman said that he was not stupid, so of course he wrote it with Terry Pratchett. so they largely wrote separate plot lines on Good Omens, and then collaborated much sort of more heavily when they were revising the manuscript. But what they did was, they did come up with the central idea, which was English countryside children's story meets the plot of The Omen.
Yeah.
And then divided up the writing with frequent conversations to discuss where it was going next. They even apparently were racing to the good bits.
Oh, that's cool.
So if they got excited about something, they like really pushed to be the one to write the first pass of it. And they were also editing each other's work. So they were passing the bits they'd written to each other to edit.
Ooh.
Until they'd both ultimately written or had impact on every character. So what do you think about that?
That's definitely got more of our vibe to it, I think, especially trying to, like, oh god, this thing's about to hit a crescendo, and I'm gonna do it, I'm gonna make it happen. That's definitely at least got my manic energy. I think if the editing is coming later, that will definitely be better, because live editing is something I'm not particularly good at.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, this month of February, I think we're just writing. We're not editing necessarily here. I think there are some bits of editing in writing, but not like a full pass of anything. Yeah. I think we'll make sure that the bits that we read out on the podcast are nice and polished. But I think beyond that, a month isn't enough time. I don't feel. I mean, you could technically do it, but you know, we both have fairly hectic lives to both write and edit. Novella, but I think for us, like, at least my goal for the end of this mini series is for us to have written the first draft of a novella together.
Yeah.
Up to 40,000 words.
Oh, that's spicy.
Yeah. What do you think about the separate plot lines thing? That's the key bit of that Gaiman and Pratchett.
It's a tough one. I think if there's like maybe it's too prescriptive to be like there. If there was like a main storyline that we know we're both writing, and then we each get a subplot to play with. But then, is it just like, do they just become alternating chapters of the different subplots, or?
Yeah, I mean, that's a question I was going to ask you later on about how chapters are going to work, which sounds like a really dull question, but I think it has the potential to be quite interesting.
I think it's quite an important one as well, because, yeah, you know, if you think about a story in terms of in-breath, out-breath, in-breath, out-breath, if it's like, ah, cool, Ben's finished his chapter, ah, yes, the massive battle's just finished, I'll write this chapter where they put all the cutlery away because the battle's over, and I'll hand it back, and then cutlery. The fight kicks off again. It's like, ah, oh, great.
Your cutlery but boy could, for the whole novel.
That could also become tedious for you, because if it's like, you're like, I really want to get some character stuff down, but I've only written people thunking hammers into each other so far.
Yeah, so what is a chapter? So, with 40,000 words,
yeah,
you could say, and roughly every 1,000 words, you need the story to be moving along in some way, which means about 40 plot points. Like, if you were going to be like the opposite of how we normally write, which is very sort of pantsery, very kinetic and very chaotic in a way. If you were going to go full, like, let's do it by the numbers, that's roughly 40 plot points maximum. You have a few plot points in a chapter, and then you end up with, you know, about 20 or so chapters. And then, theoretically, that's 10 each. You know, you can, like, just do it by the numbers.
Yeah.
That doesn't excite me very much. And I think the idea would be to use chapters as, like, one of the ways that we could use chapters is as a dialogue. Like, the tone needs to move between them. This is something that's going to evolve in the writing, I think. But I think it's important to note that at this stage, when we're talking about co-writing, we do need to think about the way that chapters live and breathe inside this novella, which should be quite interesting.
I think it's going to be difficult, but also quite refreshing, because it's never happened before for myself as a writer, or yourself, I don't think, is that sometimes you're going to finish a chapter or finish your section and think, okay, I know where this is going in my head, but knowing that it may come back completely different. Obviously, we can give notes and should give notes on.
Yeah, but the whole thing's open.
You know, this character's intention is this, and as he feels at this point is this, which I think is actually a very good document, because it also helps you to be able to say, actually, you're saying that this character is feeling filled with lust, but from how it read, I thought he was horribly constipated, which is, you know, I think that kind of active feedback can help to really firm up what the characters are like. But
what about what Robin Hobb does, where she has a spreadsheet or something like that, but she essentially has a list of all of her characters with what they're like and where they were last seen.
I think that's something, especially in a hot writing scenario like this, that could be quite useful.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like, just because if you get to it and someone's not, because they're, you know, lost in the caverns and they're wandering around like Vimes at the end of Thud.
Mm.
And we haven't seen them for 3 chapters. And you think, what happened to Frecky? Where's Frecky? And then you can look at the document and go, oh, yeah, he's in the caves. Probably do something with that.
Find him as a corpse, yeah.
there's his skeleton right there.
Excellent. You can't have a story with dwarves without them finding a skeleton at some point. That feels like it must be a trope at this stage.
It must be. That's what happens if you spend all your time underground.
Yeah, I guess so.
The skeleton is underground.
I have a couple more of this bit, because I feel like this is really quite interesting. This has been done before, typically with more like longer things like novels or series.
Yeah.
But it, there's lots of collaborative writing and co-writing that's been done and very successfully done in the past. And it does feel like it's a natural extension of our already existent recreational collaborative storytelling in tabletop. So I'm interested to apply the skills we've got from the podcast to it for sure. Right, the next one that I've got is, you know, the Expanse books, the hard sci-fi books that they made the Amazon show about. So the name of the author on those books is James S.A. Corey, which is a pen name shared by two authors.
Oh, cool.
So it's Daniel Abraham and Ty Frank are the authors of the Expanse series, but they both write under the pen name of James S.A. Corey. And the way that they do it is they split who writes each character.
Oh.
So Daniel has some, Ty has some. And I think the chapters are like based on those characters as well. Chapter structure, I mean. But then they also edit each other's work, obviously.
I don't know if I'd like that.
It's like you have the sort of mastery of one character and I have the other. I think that's too limiting.
Possibly. I feel like it creates an issue where if there's a character that you're writing, you know, you're responsible for calling Bingo the dwarf, and I've seen with Bongo the dwarf, and Bongo says, "I'm gonna slap you upside the head, Bingo." I feel like, can I accurately write on my own Bingo's response? Because really, that's your character.
Mm-hmm.
I need to then come through you and say, hey, what would he do in this situation? And then if that is the case, I might as well let you write that bit. That's a...
Yeah, I think I can see where you're coming from. I think there's there's maybe... When I read that about what they how their approach had worked, I did come up with another idea, which was to do the split the chapters thing. But actively co-write all dialogue together.
Oh.
Which could be, again, that could be laborious because it relies on us being able to like find the time to you know, have a call or be in the same room as each other as we're doing the writing.
Short roleplay sessions, yeah.
Well, I guess you're sort of doing that, aren't you? You're sort of saying, you know, what might they say next? But this is, as people may know from our, like, the various Yuletide specials and things that we've done in the past where it's more of like a radio play, we actually have a lot of fun writing like that, where it's like it's dialogue based and the two of us write it, sort of like live write it out together. So potentially that could be quite an interesting way to approach the dialogue, because everything should have a point, shouldn't it? It shouldn't just be for the sake of doing it. And so if there's going to be a conversation, it seems like we could actually get our strength in there quite easily. But that's just an idea. But it arose from the fact that I also freaked out when they said that they wrote, you know, they had hard limits on who could write which character.
Yeah. I don't think that's the one for me, at least.
It's not the one. Yeah.
I mean, even in, we've had this experience in tabletop where sometimes if one of us is, you know, running the game, and a character that someone else at the table has played for 5 years seen, if they're going to be making their character decisions or fighting to the death, will say, hey, can you pull up the sheet for Bingo the Dwarf? Because this is about to be pretty serious. But if not, we all know each other's characters well enough to then have the GM just be them for a bit if they
know how they'd react. And yeah. When they're a bit more established, you can definitely do that, I think.
Yeah.
So we'll have to see how that works as we're establishing the characters.
Yeah, I think, like, with more time, maybe, like, towards the end, we'll get better at... Mm-hmm. Well, I know this is how he's acted so far, so it's going to be fine. But especially in those first steps, I think more time together, actively figuring out who we're writing, is going to be important.
Mm-hmm. I like that. And then the final one that I've got... I can't remember who it was, but it was a husband and wife duo. I can't remember their names, but what they did was they wanted to write something together, but their styles were very different. So they invented, it's a bit like how the Expanse guys did for James S.A. Corey. they invented a pen name, but they actually invented him as a character. They created a fictional author of their books who had, and that author had its own style and had its own outlook on the world that was different from, it was the marriage of their two outlooks, basically, but turned up to 11 in a fictional author. So this would be like us saying, what would Ysteris do?
He'd make us do it.
Yeah, well, yeah, obviously, yeah. What would Ysteris want us to do? That kind of thing.
Yeah.
One's a bit zany, so I just thought I'd just throw it in there.
Yeah,
just
to... That's got take off your shoes when you're getting on the stage so that you can really connect with it vibes, isn't it?
There's a degree of artifice in novellas, I think, that's a bit more obvious than novels. I think, you know, you were sort of saying, like, novels have a bit more room for not only the author, but also the reader to lounge about in them and really, like, settle in. I think there's an awareness when you're reading a novella, as there sort of is with a short story as well, that you are reading something that somebody has constructed, and the tightness of it is a part of the experience.
Yeah.
So maybe a fictional author on top of that would be a bit much, or maybe it would really work for it, I don't know. But it's something to think of, you know. That could be an approach that we could do. We could create a person that's the two of us.
Oh, I look forward to the first work of Biko Rel. It's going to be good.
Biko Rel? It'll fly off the shelves, no doubt.
You can't have beak and fly.
So I don't know whether have we really come to a conclusion here, or is it the idea that we'll sort of do a bit more of the sort of Good Omens thing of, like, racing to the good bits and pretty much constant communication about where it's at and where it's moving and outlining the scenes and chapters so that we both know where things are?
I think for me, it's going to be sort of sticking a bit closer together at the beginning to find the people in the world. And then... Once it's like, okay, now my shoes are on and my sweatbands, and I'll see you in the good bits, and then just running. But yeah, I think
I like that.
A little bit of hand holding at the beginning, keep each other safe and warm, and then I'll push you because I don't need to outrun the bear. I only need to outrun you.
Trip me up. Okay, wicked. So I think that's. I don't know. That was potentially dry for people, I think, but I think it's really important to know what a novella is, and then also that we're discussing how we're going to approach our co-writing. And we'll be able to update you on how that works, because absolutely no plan survives contact with reality. You've got to be ready to be agile in your approach, in anything, I think, but in particular with writing, especially in a more complex writing project like this. So at least people know where we started, and we'll... Wherever we end up, they'll know we took it from this point.
Yeah.
So on to the more flavorful stuff, I think. What are your favorite aspects of dwarves and dwarven well-being? Like, what inspires you to write about dwarves?
There's a lot, but I think one of the things that I really love about dwarves and a lot of fantasy stuff, right, is when you have elves, they tend to be fantastic at everything and beautiful. And even when they're, like, waning, it's, oh, but they are still the light of the moon. But dwarves are good at so much stuff and wasting it because they're belligerent and grumpy and they hold grudges and this... They're kind of all the worst facets of the talented.
Worst facets of the talent. A great little line, I think.
But it's true. Like, when you hear about dwarves in stories, like, to go back to Gimli, it's, you know, there's lots of jokes about, oh, look, yeah, you can't keep up with Aragorn and Legolas because they're incredible athletes. But when the chips are down, Gimli's an astonishing fighter.
Yeah.
Just half the size of these, you know, Uruk-hai bred to destroy armies of men and just wading through them. because dwarves are just good at what they do. But they're so, I mean, in some ways self-righteous, in some cases they're honor-bound to the point of being self-destructive, that they would rather waste potential than see anyone else profit from their potential.
That's very jealous of it.
Yeah, it's... I don't know, I'm... For the listeners who won't know, I have a tattoo on the entirety of my upper right arm of a pair of characters called Gotrek and Felix. And Gotrek's a dwarf. And he's... I absolutely adore the character because he's got that real dwarven thing of, you know, he's a brilliant mind. He's a fantastic engineer, and he could create things that would change the world he lives in. But he's so certain that his life needs to be thrown away to repay his sins, that he doesn't make anything ever again. And to just to be willing to sit on that wealth, not just financial wealth, but wealth of ability, and then say, "Well, no, I'm not going to use it anymore because I've done not even thinking about how it could help others." You know, in a race that's dwindling, you could be doing something that helps you to repopulate or to regain the strength that they're all still pretending like they have. I think that's a place where dwarves are also really interesting, because you tend to see them on the downturn. You know, they've already dug too greedily and too deep. They've already had their best days. And now you're watching a crumbled empire thrash about violently to try and assert its dominance.
And that, what you know, and that connects with you.
Oh, big time.
Big time.
I think a lot of it is that, you know, a lot of people talk about that millennial brilliance burnout, where you were, you know, when you were in school, they said, "Oh, you're so capable, you're very clever, you can do anything." And then the world happened when you became an adult, and you went, "Oh God, I can't do anything, because anything is, you know, locked off to people with more, you know, anything's for the elves. What I can do is whatever I carve out of the stone myself." And that's, I think that's also where I really started to connect.
Like a pull yourself up by your bootstraps kind of angle to the dwarves for you as well.
Oh yeah, they're quite boomer, aren't they?
Very sort of, I guess so, yeah. Theoretically self-made, but as you've sort of said already, there's actually quite a lot of squandering of resources.
Yeah.
In the way that they approach it, even though they're very good at it. And I think that potentially evokes boomers and stuff. I mean, I think we even were talking the other day about how it would be interesting to have a fantasy world, but the different races are coded to be the generational differences from our world. Yeah. So you have like the boomers, the millennials, the Gen Xs, the Gen Ys and stuff. I think that could be a really fun thing to include in this.
I actually heard about a TikTok challenge going on the other day because, and I don't know if you're listening, but a work friend of mine called Tom, a boy who goes to school with one of his children, attempted this TikTok challenge. And the challenge, Ben, is to eat food without chewing. That's their current thing. And this boy, this young boy, had decided to eat an entire sausage without chewing.
That's ridiculous. And are we talking Cumberland or...
I didn't get the specs. I didn't get the diagnostics on the sausage, but they had to get an ambulance out.
Fucking hell!
For them to fish a sausage, unchewed sausage out of a boy's esophagus.
That's
so guess what
ridiculous.
I'm saying is that these, you know, Gen Zers, they're definitely the hobbits.
Yeah, I was gonna say that sounds like Halfling Baby to me. It's got Merry and Pippin written all over it.
But
they would be TikTok legends. Merry and Pippin.
Can you imagine?
Fucking hell!
We're just going to steal some fireworks.
And set them off inside.
It's the Robber Wizard Challenge.
Robber Wizard of his dangerous exploding sticks. So the other things that are just, I'm just going to rip through them just so we've got them. So the tropes are beards, quaffing ale, axes, hammers, you know, like cultural weapons, lots of smithing, lots of like metal smithing and being good with it. They're also typically more advanced than other races technologically.
Yes.
In settings, you know, they've always got like, they're using like water power to power mechanisms that, yeah, exactly. They also tend to have like a central authority figure, like a king.
Yes, like a deep thane or whatever,
Yeah. But the actual society itself is quite conservative socially anyway, as you were sort of saying with the boomer energy.
Yeah, you maybe get quite a lot of, there's a king, but it's not like they say, oh, hail to the king. It's the king gets to listen while they all argue about what's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And then, yeah, other than that, it's quite, usually typically quite egalitarian with like soldiers, miners, craftsmen, traders, all occupying the space of, you know, in all caps, dwarf. And then they're often very much defined by being like other. So they're all dwarfs because the other is the elves, the humans, the whatever.
There's a lot of stuff about ancestral things as well, like bloodlines are important, weapons being passed down is important, ancient grudges are often important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't like elves. Why? Because we don't. Why? Because we don't. Because we never have. We've always hated them.
Yeah, it's just, it's written down, so that makes it true.
It's like, don't make me point at the sign.
We hate elves. There, I said it. They're also typically like quite a one gender race. There's always like jokes about, you know, oh, what does a dwarven woman look like, for example, things like that. They're sort of coded as omni. I don't even know if that's an accurate term, but do you know what I mean? Like they could be any. It doesn't matter. Like it's not a thing for them.
I think an interesting character to think about as well with this kind of stuff is Kara Ironfounderson.
Yep, Discworld. Yep.
The good old headbanger. Just because being short does not make a dwarf necessarily.
Yeah, it's almost more of a religion, isn't it? Like you can, as long as
it's a way of life.
A way of life, yes. Way of life is better than religion, I think. Like there's a way of approaching your existence that makes you a dwarf. Yeah. I like that. I think so. These are all like fun aspects, but they are like tropes, and I feel like we should really be working to make sure that we, you know, explore the ones that we like, but also put our own spin on it and really make it feel fresh and different. Because there isn't much point in, with any, whenever I'm writing fantasy, I never really feel like there's much point in just writing what's come before. I'm always trying to move it on. The one exception, I can't remember which episode it was, but I deliberately wrote a very traditional fantasy story for one of the episodes a long time ago. Where the character like wakes up after a head injury, and they're not entirely sure where they are, but they're in a sort of like a dungeon, in like a Dungeons and Dragons dungeon. I remember struggling with it at the time, and it's just like, it's because it's not exciting. Like new outlooks, new spins on things, new points of view to examine a world, or a, you know, in this instance, like a fantasy race, make things really engaging. So I think we should always have that outlook. It would be my tuppence there.
Yeah, I fully agree. I've read a lot of stuff about dwarves, so I think anything that makes me go, oh, I haven't seen that before, gets me excited. And especially in versions of the tropes. But, you know, there was a great short story. It's actually a Godric and Felix one, but where they're trying to make some money, so they get work in an arena, and there's all these people around them, and they raise a platform with a griffin chained to it. Well, obviously the idea being that these two heroes will fight the griffin, and Gotrek smashes through the chains, and that's a beautiful animal. I would rather fight and kill everyone watching me than kill that. Because there aren't many left, but there are loads of humans, and I'll fight every one of them. And like that moment of, oh, because you know you're used to him just going, well, that's a monster, I'll kill it. And they're like, no, this is a beautiful creature, and it deserves life more than these people braying for its blood do. That sort of thing is what makes characters interesting. So I think if we can find those moments of, you know, expectation being rug pulled, that makes stories exciting for me.
Bit of subversion, yeah, I like that. Yeah, so we sort of discussed what dwarves are to us, and you know, I really enjoyed just hearing you talk about dwarves. So I'm looking forward to writing about them with you as well. We sort of discussed what a novella is and how we might approach the co-writing, but in terms of, you know, what our central idea is, you know, what's the seed that we're going to write for next week, for example. There's another Ian McEwan quote that I just want to mention here, talking about the novella, and he's discussing the length of it. And he says, it's something between 20 and 40,000 words, long enough for a reader to inhabit a world or a consciousness and be kept there, but short enough to be read in a sitting or two, and for the whole structure to be held in mind at first encounter. I feel like that's got like quite a lot to unpack to it. Yeah. So we want to build a world around this like concept of dwarves, but it has to be reasonably short. And then this idea of the structure, so like the pacing of it, is to be like clean. That feels like it needs to be a fairly like solid arc, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, is it a quest arc? Are they under siege? Is the, you know, there's a whole wealth of like of fantasy stories that have different heroes' journeys and different approaches to that old kind of storytelling. But I think we should always, everything that we do in this should always be like centered around what our central idea about the dwarves is. So what is that? What do we want from this? What's the seed?
I feel like a quest is at least a good leaping off point, even if it then turns out that the quest is nothing. They, you know, oh, but it's led to something different. You know, maybe maybe finding a thing they didn't know would be there, or it, you know, it can be, sometimes those things can fall flat, but there's a good example in the sixth Harry Potter book, where Dumbledore drinks the evil juice with the seashell to try and get to the to one of the Horcruxes, and when they get there, someone had already done it.
Mm.
So they went through all of that effort for nothing because someone beat them there, and it reset. And I think in that instance, especially if you know, we like what we're writing and we want more stories, and we start to, you know, maybe fall in love with the world a little bit, I think having the idea that maybe some of the characters, and I have got some character ideas, maybe some of them are on a, well, we're on a quest because that's what you're meant to do, and then finding out along the way that the world isn't a fairy tale, that life isn't quite as simple as hero go here, hero do thing. I think that's a good leaping off point, because it means you can kind of load the gun with fantasy tropes and then throw the gun in the river and start doing backflips instead.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think I definitely followed you there. It gels with something that I was quite keen on the idea of, which is there's a kind of character archetype, and I haven't fully explored this, but they're typically like a catalyzing agent for the sort of midpoint, and whatever story it is eventually changes and unfolds. But essentially, you have your main character and your ancillary characters, and they're sort of going along. And then a character turns up with just such a different outlook that it spirals everything. I think that's sort of, you were talking about that in like a structure way, and I think maybe we use a character to do that.
So I'll read you what I have written down. So we'd spoken off mic actually about some character concepts, but only sort of briefly. But the idea of a dwarf who's lived outside of dwarven society for whatever reason, because of an ancestral banishment or because they were shunned.
Yep.
And to have other young dwarves come through where they are and sort of just seize them up. And maybe not even in a, oh, well, they're dwarves, so I should go with them, but in a, you're a dwarf, so you have to come with us. That's just, that's what dwarves do. And not even being able to argue with it. I think there's something, something interesting in there. It's like someone with no wanderlust being adventured by force.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's good. That's almost like, that could be a start, that could be a mid. Like, that could be, yeah, I think we can really play around with that concept. And yeah, then
actually, as a mid, that's a really interesting idea to have these sort of two, these adventurous people story running sort of in parallel, and the for the reader to know that at some point these two worlds are going to collide, and it's going to be difficult for a character they're watching just have a normal life.
Yeah, they are going to change each other's lives by interacting. Which should really be the case most of the time, unless you're deliberately trying to create like an area of peace and sanctuary inside the work. It's, I think characters talking to each other should often be quite dynamic. Almost certainly. And then, so another question, right? Just in terms of like the seas and the shape of it and the feel of it.
Yeah.
What's the tone? Because, you know, I often write quite serious things, and you have a real flair for comedy writing. And I feel like we'd be fools if we didn't try and get both things in.
I think the trick we need is to have, and I've got this idea about this pair of twins who share an ancestral axe. And I've absolutely
yes,
fallen,
I do know this idea. Yeah.
I've absolutely fallen in love with this concept of these two dwarves who, you know, maybe they're, you know, very, very gifted, but both unwilling to go and get another axe because they should be using the ancestral axe. So, you know, in fights, they're sort of throwing it across the room to each other in time with dwarven songs. But it's like,
yeah,
come on, this is... Chuck it here. You know, they don't want to watch their twin die, so they do have to pass it. And I think to have characters like that who are inherently funny, because even in a very, very bleak world, you'll meet funny people and funny things will happen. And I think writing a story that at its heart is very true and very deep and has space for politics will actually let the punchline shine. Because, as we know from writing together, when we've done it briefly, my brain will just hand me punchlines. if we choose when to fire those into the story, I think they could be, you know, sometimes absolutely blisteringly funny, and sometimes it could be heartbreaking. You know, someone trying to make a joke in the dark moment, or someone suffering because they couldn't help but make the joke, or... So I think a real serious world with some funny characters, because people, like, just looking at the two of us, you're a very serious, very intelligent man, but you can be extremely funny. And I'm a bit of a jokester, but I can be very serious when the moment calls for it. And knowing that people and worlds have that kind of dynamism, I think will help it to feel more fleshed out, especially in that short space, because you want them to, you don't want to spend ages and ages on making someone feel real if you can make them feel like a real person in, you know, 1,000 words, because we got to crack on because it's a novella.
Yeah. Okay. So I think we're getting there. Like, this idea of, so there's a bit of a tragicomedy thing happening.
Yeah.
Maybe a quest gone awry kind of narrative as well. Yeah. And then it sounds like so far we're definitely talking about like the ancestral weapons stuff, like the bloodlines of the dwarves in this, potentially in like a failing civilization. I would really like to bring in the stuff that I wrote in the story that sort of sparked us down this path, which was the this idea of that the language is compromised. Because language is really important. Like, written language is always written really important for dwarves in fiction, I think.
Yeah.
And the idea that they're missing letters or words because of a, you know, some sort of problem with them, that they, there's some sort of magic that means that that those words are damaged beyond use.
Yeah.
Or the use of them is dangerous. I think that gives me the right kind of tingles inside whatever we do with the dwarves.
I think it could be interesting to have, what if, you know, dwarf generations only happen once every X years, and it's a really long time. So you've got this young generation, and there aren't that many people left to teach them the words, or even to teach them which words you shouldn't use. And the idea of ancestral stuff feels important because it's old, but it doesn't really hold much water if you pull it apart. I think having...
There's space there, I think. There's some meat on the bone.
Characters who don't really know the full extent of the world, so they can find it at the same time as the reader. I think that could be really good.
Well, right, okay. Well, I think we've got a start. I think we've potentially given people an insight into how these kind of collaborative processes work for us. You know,
yeah.
It typically starts with a bit more kind of like rough ideas, and then we will start to get excited about things when, well, I'm already excited about it, but you start to get really excited about it when you start to realize what you can do with it in terms of your writing and the storytelling. So I think this is probably a fairly good place to leave this, because I think we've given people an idea of where the seed is, where the starting point is, and what our approach is going to be. And next week, we just get to read a bit out of what we've written and feed it back. What do you think?
I'm really excited.
Yeah? I'm excited as well. It's a real departure for us to do something like this, but I'm excited about it. We'll have to see what it reads like next week.
We'll see you there, gang.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of The Tiny Bookcase.
Remember to subscribe, otherwise you're going to miss out on the future fun.
Also, tell a friend. If you like this episode, link them to it.
We'd be tremendously grateful. You can follow us on Twitter at BookcaseTiny, Facebook at The Tiny Bookcase, and Instagram at BookcaseTiny for updates. Speaking of supporting the podcast, well, magic can only take one so far. The Tiny Bookcase is supported by the generosity of its patrons. Those kind souls have really kept my belly full the last year. Let's cast a spell for them, shall we? For rich ginger tones on their scalp, let us cast the Orangi Hedondo spell for Scott Byrne. And for general fabulousness, why not the Ooh La La How's Your Mother spell on Matthew McLaren?
How do you come up with that shit, man?